The second reading comes from James, chapter 1, verses 1 to 18. James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations, greetings. Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work, so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. If any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. But when you ask, you must believe and not doubt, because the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. That person should not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Such a person is double-minded and unstable in all they do. Believers in humble circumstances ought to take pride in their high position, but the rich should take pride in their humiliation, since they will pass away like a wildflower. For the sun rises with scorching heat and withers the plant. Its blossom falls and its beauty is destroyed. In the same way, the rich will fade away, even while they go about their business. Blessed is the one who perseveres under trial, because having stood the test, that person will receive the crown of life that the Lord has promised to those who love him. When tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each person is tempted when they are dragged away by their own evil desire and enticed. Then, after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. Don't be deceived, my dear brothers and sisters. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of the heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. He chose to give us birth through the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of all he created. This is the word of the Lord.
You don't have to travel far through this journey called life before you face pain and suffering. Suffering is a universal human experience, and explanations or philosophies of why we suffer are as universal as suffering is. There would be, even this morning, a lot of stories of pain, some of it buried a long way underneath the surface of your life, others, for others it's quite raw and close. At some point, you're going to have to explore. We're going to have to explore and have a theology or a way of thinking through as Christian people how we deal with it. Prominent scientist and self-professed atheist and author Richard Dawkins talks about suffering in this way in his book River Out of Eden. And this is a naturalist view of suffering. Some of it might appear up on the screen for us. The total amount of suffering per year in the natural world, he says, is beyond all decent contemplation. In a universe of blind physical forces and genetic contemplation, in genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, he says. Other people are going to get lucky. And you won't find rhythm and rhyme to it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe, he writes, has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at the bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. Now, there's a naturalist view of suffering for you. There's no creator, therefore there's no reason. We are the victims in that worldview or that schema, victims of impersonal forces that bear upon our lives. And therefore, the only legitimate reason or response to suffering that I can think of is to avoid it. Can you think of another reason or another way to deal with suffering with that worldview? If there's no meaning or reason or purpose to it, run from it. But I wonder what happens when it catches you, when it runs faster than you do. That's the real trouble with the naturalist view of suffering. Doesn't matter how far you avoid it, how far you run from it, it's going to catch you. And I can imagine it will overwhelm and crush you. By contrast, consider the Christian worldview of suffering that's touched upon in this book of James. Consider it, he writes in verse 2, pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials. Now that's going to be a key word for us this morning, trials of many kinds. Because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature, complete, not lacking anything. For Christians, suffering is central to our worldview. Our Old Testament reading was written by a fellow called Jeremiah. He is known as the weeping prophet. We have at the core of our faith the Easter narrative about the crucified Jesus Christ who suffered for us. He was a man acquainted with sorrow and grief. And one theologian went so far as to name his book or call his book The Crucified God. Now that idea is blasphemous to the Jew, blasphemous to the Muslim, it's nonsense to the atheist, but it is for us the linchpin of our faith. Not only that God got his hands dirty by entering into our time and space, but that in Jesus Christ, God willingly suffers, purposefully puts himself as the victim of the worst of humanity, and does so with a joy. There's a little verse that's tucked away in Hebrews, which I never saw for a long, long time, but I saw in the last decade of my ministry. It's the context of the race. We're all on a journey. Let us fix our eyes upon Jesus. You know that verse, don't you? The author and the perfecter of our faith. But the next part of it, who for the joy set before him, scorned the shame of the cross and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. That is, Jesus Christ was a figure whom we are called to follow and emulate, who experienced together great suffering, sadness, grief, and at the same time, joy. There's a paradox there. I like paradoxes. You're learning this about me. There's something that was deeper than his sadness and his pain that warmed his heart and motivated him and drove him. And what was that? The joy set before him. The joy of winning you and I to him. The joy of winning a victory over death. The joy of reconciling everything in heaven and on earth to him through the cross and the resurrection and the exaltation. I don't think Jesus was a stoic. He wasn't an Englishman, right? No, I'm an Englishman. Don't worry. It's okay to be an Englishman. But he wasn't a stoic. But I think he was a man who simultaneously felt grief and yet joy. And I think James has the same in mind for us. Not a stoic denial of your pain, but an embrace of all the grief and sadness which is in your life, and yet at the same time, an experience of a deeper joy that warms your heart and drives your life. And the word that James uses here for suffering is very informative. It's the word trials. There is testing. Or perhaps another word that we might use is training. I think what James is saying is, don't waste your suffering. I have a friend in ministry who I often debrief with, and he says, Scott, what can you learn from that? So now I know what he's going to say to me. I think about it beforehand, so I've got a good answer for him. Don't waste your suffering, Scott. Have a goal to it. Understand the context and the growth which is supposed to work in your life. This is the idea here. Let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking in anything. You are on a journey. You are called to mature and to be all that God would have for you. And if you believe in a good God, who has, by the way, suffered for you, for the joy set before him, then you will see that these circumstances are not impersonal forces that bear upon your life from which you have to run as far as possible and hope they don't catch up. But no, there is a good God who can redeem what is happening to you for your good, for your maturity. This is very different to the naturalist worldview, isn't it? DNA just is, and we dance to its music. This is a very different view. It's a view which is formed out of a future hope and a journey and a wholeness to which you are called to. I was reading this week a book in preparation for this by Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning. Now, some of you may have heard of this book. It's a classic. 9 million copies sold, the front cover says. And he's a Jewish psychiatrist who worked as a doctor in Auschwitz in the Holocaust camps. And he, in this book, discusses many aspects of what humanity is, but one of them is the relationship between hope and a future vision and the suffering which we experience in the present life. And he tells the story about the connection between giving up, of being overwhelmed, and losing a picture of where we're called to be. He tells the story of a fellow inmate, a fairly well-known composer, he says, who confided in me, that is Viktor Frankl, one day, that he'd had a dream that he felt was prophetic. And the dream told him when the war would end and liberation would come to his camp. "When did you have this dream?" Viktor Frankl asked him. "In February 1945, he answered. "It was then the beginning of March. "What did your dream voice tell you in terms of the date?" He whispered, "March 30th. When my inmate told me about his dream, he was still full of hope, Viktor Frankl writes, and convinced that the voice of his dream would be right. But as the promised day drew nearer, the war news which reached our camp made it appear very unlikely that we would be free on that promised date. On March 29th, he suddenly became ill and ran a high temperature. On March 30th, the day of his prophecy that had told him that the war and the suffering would be over for him, he became delirious and lost consciousness. On March 31st, he was dead. To all outward appearances, he had died of typhus. But his point is he died of a loss of hope. That we need in our suffering to have hope. We are hope-filled creatures. We need a concept of journey and calling in order to do what James calls us to do here, which is persevere. Now, given this, let me just share four bits of wisdom. Maybe they're from James, maybe they're from me, probably they're from books I've read over the years. Let me share four ideas of wisdom for how to find meaning in suffering. Up on the screen, I think they are. Firstly, what is suffering for? What can suffering do for you? It tests you, actually. It asks questions of you. It exposes your flaws. Have you noticed that when you're under stress? When bad things happen, you learn things about yourself you would never have learned before. Where your confidence is, what you value, how self-controlled you are. When you are under stress, when suffering comes to you, you learn about your weaknesses in a way that you can face yourself with the goodness of God before you and repent. God gives you a gift in suffering of growing in your character. That's point number one. I'm going to go pretty quick here. Number two, it gives you a chance to reevaluate your life. It can give you a wake-up call, actually. I've spent lots and lots of time as an oncology, hematology, and palliative care nurse in pastoral ministry speaking to people who have been confronted with serious illness in their life. And it doesn't always have this effect, but I've heard it time and time again that what it does is it brings perspective to people. I've heard people talk about their scare with cancer as a blessing or a gift to them. Three, suffering gives you a chance to trust in God, to have confidence in Him in a way you would never have if you hadn't gone through that trial or that suffering. We place our confidence in lots of things. And when you suffer, you are asked, it tests your faith, who do you have confidence in? And fourthly, it increases your capacity for empathy. Until you suffer, you are limited in your capacity to care for others. Let me give you an example. In 1998-ish, Nat was diagnosed with Crohn's disease. Now, we were both nurses at the time, and I'd never heard of Crohn's disease, never. I had to go and look it up in my textbooks that I was given in nursing school, right? She had surgery, and she's been relatively well since. But, you know, after she was diagnosed with Crohn's disease, the incidence of Crohn's disease went up all of a sudden. Now, do they really? No. But suddenly my awareness of that disease and its sister diseases like ulcerative colitis, suddenly I became aware of them in a way that I never was before. It increased my capacity to connect with others who are also suffering. Think about it. Who instinctively do you want to be comforted by? You want a high priest, to use Jesus' terms, who can sympathize with you, who's got scars on him. And so it is with ministry of that high priest through people. Four bits of wisdom to find meaning in your suffering. It can grow your character. It can give you perspective. It can cause you to trust or give you an opportunity to trust in God in a fresh way. And it can give you a capacity to minister to others. And that is the Christian life, isn't it? Ministry to others. The most important thing is to see that God has called us to be something more than just random dancing to random music of DNA that Dawkins spoke about. Our life is not random, but it's purposeful. And God promises to give us wisdom. Verse 5, if any of you lacks wisdom, ask God who gives generously to all without finding fault. We need wisdom to face suffering and to see them as trials, training ground in our walk with God. And wisdom will give you the ability to see suffering as a way to shape you, not meaningless music to which you must dance, but it will give you new music, the music of the gospel. And then you will have both deep sadness, as you should, and yet underlying joy. Most people, I think, actually respond to suffering neither in joy or in sadness, but some in anger, actually. Not raging, but resentment. Have you ever felt that? Most Christian people, think suffering is a punishment from God, subconsciously. And so what happens is, if you are someone who thinks of themselves as living a good life, and you experience suffering, what you'll do is you'll get angry at God, or you'll get resentful towards him. You'll say, I don't deserve this, God. I've lived a good life. Why is this happening to me? Or if you haven't lived a good life, what you'll do is you'll go, I deserve this. God's punishing me and he should. I've met those type of people. But you know, the gospel actually says neither of those things. The gospel says no one has lived a good enough life except for Jesus Christ. God doesn't give you what is owed to you. Instead, he suffers for you. And for the joy that is set before him, he scorns the shame of the cross. He ascends to the right hand of the Father so you can have, in verse 12, the crown of life given to you at the end of the race. That is, suffering is not punishment so that you'll feel more guilty. Jesus has borne that for you. Nor is it a reason to be angry with God because you think you've lived a good life and you deserve better. Rather, suffering is there to shape you. It's a trial. Jesus modeled it first, and we are called to follow him and to entrust ourselves to the one who walks with us in our suffering. That's wisdom.